Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents The Midnight Project Number 2, Revolution, by Joseph Nassis. Narrated by Marissa Clay, with a full cast.
Huh? Something touched my face in the darkness, and I woke with a start, my heart hammering in my chest like I'd just been jabbed with a cattle prod. My eyes snapped open, and I frantically searched the room for whatever the hell it was that had just touched me. The pre-dawn half-light coming in through the nearby window revealed the darkened silhouette of a figure crouched near the end of the couch I was lying on. Afraid that my enemies had somehow managed to track me back to the safe house while I slept, I reacted without thought, kicking out with my right foot and feeling a satisfying thud as my heel connected solidly with whoever or whatever was looming there. The figure went over backward, giving me time to scramble to my feet so that I was standing unsteadily on the couch cushions. My thoughts raced with the events of the last few days. Assistant Director Black's attempt to frame us for a crime we didn't commit, an act that ultimately led from our flight from the project, the meeting with Ghost, and our agreement to make those that hurt us pay for what they had done, our decision to find and secure the pieces of the Gladius Diaboli for ourselves rather than let them fall into others' hands, our ill-fated three-way confrontation with the Angel of Darkness and her minions on one side, and Black and the project's soldiers on the other. All that flashed through my mind in an instant, and if our enemies had indeed found me, I was determined to give as good as I got. I raised my hands and reached out with my senses, drawing power from the air around me. A deep blue light swiftly gathered around my fists, throwing off sparks of arcane power as it did so, and I got ready to hurl it at whoever had the audacity to come for me in my sleep. As I brought my hand back, a voice shouted out in the darkness.
Jess, no! It's me!
I knew that voice. I'd been hearing it on a daily basis for months now, and would probably have recognized it even in my sleep. Ephraim! Oh my God, Ephraim! I let the light surrounding my fist grow brighter, lighting up the room and giving me a look at him. Whether a result of his rapid healing ability, or simply due to the fact that he hadn't been seriously injured in the first place, I was relieved to see that he had appeared physically intact. He was covered in dirt, soot, and a fine gray powder that I could only imagine was bone dust. His hair was plastered to his head, and his clothing was torn in several places. In short, he was a mess. I didn't care. I let the power I was holding dissipate back into the ether and threw myself at him, wrapping him up in a savage hug. I'm not sure who was more surprised at my sudden show of emotion, him or me, but frankly, it made little difference. He was alive. That was all that mattered. After a moment, I pulled back and looked him in the eye, concern for the still missing member of our trio dampening my joy at Ephraim's sudden appearance. Nikolai?
I don't know. All that power getting thrown about brought the roof down. When I finally dug myself out from under the pile of rubble that fell on my head, the place was full of well-meaning rescue workers clawing through the rubble. It was all I could do to slip away in the shadows without being seen. Did you get away with the blade?
I had to be honest. It took me a moment to figure out what he was even talking about. In the rush to escape the enemy and reach the safe house the night before, never mind the utter exhaustion I'd felt after wielding so much power in so short a time, I'd forgotten all about our reason for going to the church in the first place. I reached behind me to the small of my back and pulled the hilt of the weapon out of the waistband of my jeans, right where I'd stashed it while running away from the firefight the night before. I held it up to show him I had it. Let me get the light so you can see it better. Together, we got our first good look at the artifact we'd fought so hard to recover. Research I'd conducted after Black had first informed me of the weapon's existence told me that the word gladius originally referred to any sword from the Roman period. Over time, however, the meaning had narrowed, coming to refer instead to the narrow, double-edged blade with a tapered point, used for stabbing and thrusting, carried by Roman legionnaires from the 3rd century BC onward. The blades were anywhere from 18 to 27 inches in length, depending upon the particular style, and the hilt of a gladius, the capulus, was often an ornate affair, especially if the weapon belonged to an officer or a dignitary, with ridges for fingers along the grip and a rounded pommel at the base. The portion of the weapon I'd recovered from the bone church the night before consisted of the capulis and about 3 inches of exposed blade. The blade itself ended in a ragged diagonal break, making it pretty useless as a weapon in its present state. Not that I intended to use it as such.
Doesn't look like much, does it?
No, it didn't. But then again, the true value of this weapon had nothing to do with the length of its blade or how pretty it might be. Just be thankful we managed to get to it before the others did.
Oh, trust me, I am.
I knew exactly how he felt. The events of the last week had been a literal nightmare, to say the least. The failed mission to Lucky's, that strip club in Bridewell, Oklahoma, where we'd unsuccessfully taken on a Class 4 target, Eduardo Torres, followed by the slightly more successful smash and grab in Great Falls, Virginia. Successful, that is, until we'd returned to the base and discovered that the safe we'd nicked was completely empty. That's where things had really hit the fan, concluding with the Midnight Project's assistant director, Claudia Black, accusing the three of us, Nikolai, Ephraim, and me, of stealing a piece of the Gladius Diaboli, the mystical artifact that was supposed to be in the safe. Things had only snowballed from there. With Ghost's help, we'd discovered Black's plot to force us to take the blame for the theft, and that had led to our escape from the project and our subsequent attempts to find a piece of the Gladius ourselves. A search that ultimately proved successful, but also led to the three-way battle we'd fought the night before inside the Bone Church, against soldiers from the Project, led by Black herself on one side, and the Angel of Darkness, Black's twin sister Delilah, and her shape-shifting allies on the other. We'd escaped with the hilt of the Gladius, but lost Nikolai in the process. We have to know what happened to Nikolai. I'm thinking we need to return to the church to search for him.
I can't exactly go out looking like this.
He gestured, indicating the ash that completely covered him.
Might be a bit of a giveaway that we were involved somehow, don't you think?
He was right. In my haste to find out what had happened to Nikolai, I'd skipped right over the obvious. But now that he'd brought it up, I realized we had a problem. We thought we were effectively off the radar when it came to both the Project and the Angel and her united factions. None of us had expected to encounter resistance at the church. We thought we'd make a quick side trip to Kutnohora, recover the piece of the blade, and be back at our hotel in Prague a few hours later. In and out, quick and easy. As a result, we'd left everything but the clothes on our backs in a rental locker at the train station, which meant that neither of us had anything to change into.
Well, this apartment is a rental, right? Look around. Maybe the owner's left something we can use.
It was a sensible idea, and so obvious that I was surprised I hadn't thought of it myself, showing how frazzled the events of the last 24 hours had made me. The house was a single-story, two-bedroom affair. The front door opened into a large room that spanned the width of the house, the front half furnished as a living room space that was separated from the kitchen in the back half by a long but narrow breakfast bar. A short corridor ran off to the left of the kitchen, with a bedroom on either side and a bathroom at the end of the hall. All of which I'd discovered upon my arrival the night before. After pointing out the location of the much-needed shower to Ephraim, I took his advice and did some poking around. Like many rental properties in this era of Airbnb and Vrbo, the owners didn't so much clear out their personal belongings entirely, but instead gathered them up and put them in storage for the rental season. A set of double doors secured with a padlock in the second bedroom suggested I might have found their stash. I grabbed the lock and turned it upward so that I could see the keyhole. Bending closer, I drew in a breath, then blew it inside the keyhole, mentally imagining the tumblers falling into place as my breath moved over them and jerking down sharply on the body of the lock at the same time. I slipped the lock free and opened the double doors of the closet, revealing shelves stuffed full of clear plastic storage bins. Several of them contained clothing. I pulled a few of those out, putting them on the bed behind me. I did a quick dig through their contents, looking for something that would fit Ephraim. The first two bins held nothing but children's clothing. The third, however, held several pairs of jeans that looked like they might fit, and a selection of plain colored t-shirts in various sizes. Grabbing some that I thought would fit Ephraim, I brought them back to the bathroom and set them on the sink counter so he would find them when he stepped out of the shower. With a set of clothes for myself in hand, I retired to one of the bedrooms to take stock of my own situation, using the mirror above the dresser to see just how bad things were.
It wasn't pretty. While I wasn't painted in ash and bone dust the way Ephraim was, I certainly hadn't escaped from last night's confrontation entirely unscathed either. Dirt covered my face in splotches, and there were chips of what looked like bone fragments tangled in my long hair. My clothes hadn't fared much better. Dust and grime covered them in patches from my rush down the centuries-old tunnel, and there was a sizable chunk of missing fabric surrounded by scorch marks where the angel's fireball had burned it away upon contact. The flesh beneath was a festering mess. I'd done what I could to try and heal the injury the night before, but something had kept my magic from fully activating, and the flesh where I'd been burned was oozing slightly and was damned painful to the touch. I'd barely noticed it in the excitement of finding Ephraim alive, but looking at it now, it suddenly hit me like a sledgehammer to the face. Something was going to have to be done about it, or I wasn't going anywhere. I sat on the bed and gingerly stripped out of my shirt. The bruises that covered my upper body, courtesy of the fall I'd taken after being struck by the aforementioned fireball, explained why I felt like I'd been run over by a truck. My skin was dark purple and angry-looking, the flesh beneath clearly swollen. The largest bruise covered nearly my entire left side, from my collarbone to just above my hip. Other, smaller bruises were scattered across my back and right shoulder. If I was going to be even halfway useful today, I needed to do something about both the bruises and the burn. Closing my eyes, I held my hand open with the palm down over the burn and imagined my flesh knitting itself back together. Picturing the blood vessels reconnecting and carrying my precious lifeblood to the injured areas, soothing and healing them. When that was finished, I turned my attention to the bruise covering the left side of my body. Imagining it growing lighter and fading away as the inflammation around the afflicted area swiftly receded. I could feel the flesh tightening in response to my will, and when I opened my eyes, the burn was gone, and all that was left of that massive bruise was a slight yellowing discoloration to my skin. Finished with my impromptu healing session, I turned to the clothes I'd pulled out of the closet and quickly got dressed. The jeans were a little long, but nothing that rolling the cuffs up a few times wouldn't take care of. The t-shirt, on the other hand, hung down to mid-thigh and was clearly sizes too big. Beggars can't be choosers, I reminded myself. Gathering the extra material off to one side of my waist, I tied it into a knot to keep it out of the way. I might not look like a fashion icon, but at least I wouldn't be tripping when I had to move quickly. I turned my attention to the blade. I was leery of carrying it around with me. We were, after all, returning to the scene of the crime, so to speak, and there was no guarantee that either the Angel or Black hadn't posted someone to keep an eye out for our return. Getting caught with it on my person didn't seem like the best idea, but leaving it lying around unguarded here at the safe house didn't sit well with me either. I needed to find a hiding place, a good one. I thought about all the usual places I'd heard about over the years. In the tank of the toilet, within the panels of a low-hanging ceiling, stuffed inside a slash made in the side of a mattress, dropped in the space beneath a pried-up floorboard, taped to the underside of a piece of furniture. I didn't like any of them. They all felt too obvious. That's when my gaze fell on the heating vent just above the lintel of the bedroom door. It was small, a few inches in height and no more than 6 in length. Given the amount of dust and grime covering the front, it looked like no one had paid any attention to it for a decade or more. It was just about perfect. I grabbed a chair from the corner and placed it just inside the doorway. I climbed up on top of it so that I could reach the vent. There were 4 screws, one in each corner, that were holding the metal grate in place. I didn't have a screwdriver handy. Not that it mattered. The amount of rust built up around them told me they were unlikely to twist even if I could. Thankfully, there was an easier way. I reached out and put my finger against the head of the first screw. I imagined the screw turning beneath my touch, spinning counterclockwise as easily as if it had only been installed 5 minutes before. As I did so, I sent a little push of power into the screw's direction and then slowly drew my finger back. The screw came with it, smooth as silk. I grabbed it with my other hand before it could fall to the floor, and then repeated the process with the other 3 screws. I put them in my pocket so I wouldn't lose them, then turned my attention to the faceplate covering the vent. A few hearty tugs later, I had that in my hands as well. There was just enough light in the room to let me see that the ventilation shaft ran back from the opening, just a few inches before it bisected another shaft running perpendicular to it. Dust coated the interior of the shaft, confirming my earlier suspicion that the vent hadn't been removed in years. I hopped down off the chair, picked up our hard-won portion of the blade, and wrapped it in one of the extra t-shirts I'd pulled from the closet. Climbing back up on the chair, I very carefully reached down the throat of the vent pipe, being certain not to disturb any of the dust on the surface, and placed the now wrapped bundle just around the bend to the left. Then, I just as carefully pulled my hand back out. A quick peek confirmed that the bundle couldn't be seen from where I stood, so I replaced the faceplate and secured it with the screws, using the same method as before, but in reverse. The vent was just high enough that someone standing inside the room, looking about, couldn't see inside it without getting up on the chair the way I had. If they did that, and then looked directly into the vent, they still wouldn't see anything. If they went to the trouble to remove the faceplate, the lack of disturbance in the dust on the surface of the vent pipe should discourage any thoughts that something might have been hidden inside it. Hopefully, it would only be there for a short time anyway. By the time I was finished, Ephraim emerged from the bathroom, dressed in the clothing that I'd found for him. I was gratified that they fit him much better than mine fit me. At least one of us would look halfway normal.
What's the plan?
First, we find Nikolai. After that, we'll refocus our efforts on finding the pieces of the blade.
Sounds good, but where do you want to start?
I think our best bet would be to return to the church and see if we could pick up Nikolai's trail from there.
I don't disagree with you, but isn't that like sticking our heads back in the lion's mouth?
Let's be honest. Returning to the scene of the crime wasn't the smartest move we could make at this point. I had no doubt that the Project, and most likely the Angels people as well, would have someone watching the location just in case we did that very thing. Yet, we didn't have any choice. Not if we wanted to find Nikolai. That didn't mean we had to go in unprepared, though. We needed some way to make it look like we belonged at the scene, and I had just the idea in mind. It was a trick I'd picked up from a book about a necromancer in Los Angeles, and I'd been dying to give it a try in the real world. Now seemed like the perfect time. Returning to the locked closet where I'd found the clothes we were now wearing, I cut a flap off one of the boxes and then cut the flap into two pieces. I folded both pieces in half horizontally so they looked like billfolds, and then used a magic marker I found to mark each piece. On the top half, I drew an oval and wrote BSI, short for Bezpečnostní informační služba, the Czech equivalent of the FBI, inside it. I made a few wavy lines on the bottom to simulate text and drew a rectangle with the word ID inside that. When I was finished, I put a suggestion spell on both, charging them with my will so that the viewer would see what I wanted them to see, namely a federal police badge and a photo ID that matched each of us. Here you go.
Hey, you even managed to find a decent headshot.
The church was in ruins. From where we stood on the other side of the street, we could see that only about a fifth of the structure still stood, a corner section at the back of the church, where two walls and a bit of the ceiling held together, as if determined to resist by sheer force of will alone, the destruction that had rained down upon the rest of the building. It wasn't lost on me that it was the area above the tunnel through which I'd escaped the night before, and I said a silent prayer to the long-dead masons who had built the place for their attention to load-bearing supports and whatever else it was that had kept the place from falling down upon my head. The rest of the building and the chapel that lay beneath it hadn't been so lucky. The building had collapsed inward, smashing through the floor and leaving a great heaping pile of rubble burying the ossuary deep beneath it. Looking at the destruction, I was amazed that Ephraim had lived through it. If he'd been entirely human, I was certain he wouldn't have. Yellow caution tape had been erected around the property, and we could see a group of locals surrounding several film crews, most likely representing stations based in Prague. I spotted a reporter and the camera crew getting ready to do a live shot and wandered over. I stayed to the back of the nearby crowd, close enough to hear what was being said, but not where I might be asked for my thoughts as a local bystander on the scene.
Thank you, Teresa. This is Konstantin Cermak with Česká televize, And I'm here this morning at the Sedlick Ossuary, commonly known as the Bone Church, for the thousands of human bones that were used to decorate its macabre interior. It is situated in the lower section of the Cemetery Church of All Saints, here in Kutna Hora. But as you can see from the view over my shoulder, there's not much left of either the church or the ossuary. As of right this moment, what we understand is that this was the site of a meeting last night between two sets of individuals, a meeting that turned extraordinarily violent, resulting in the deaths of at least five people and the near destruction of the building around them. While it hasn't been officially confirmed, sources close to the investigation tell us that at least one of the deceased was a member of an organized crime group.
I'd heard all I needed to hear. They had no idea what had really happened. That was clear. And I was equally certain that the spin doctors from the project would no doubt already be at work making sure that the truth never came out. Fall guys would be found to pin the destruction on, and at some point the police would announce that they'd caught some poor sod who would end up paying the price for the crime, innocent or not. Just one small sacrifice to keep the masses ignorant of the true nature of the world around them. Some would say it was a meager price to avoid mass hysteria. For a time, I was one of those people. Now, I wasn't so sure. Turning, I walked to where Ephraim was standing in the shadows of a large tree, watching the activity taking place amidst the ruins of the church. Portable arc lamps on large tripods had been set up around the site to provide more light in the early morning dimness, and rescue workers in bright yellow vests were carefully moving about the rubble, searching for the living and the dead. A pair of dogs were assisting in the search, and as we watched, one of them alerted, leaning down on its front paws and barking at the rubble in front of it. Shouts went up, rescue workers rushed over, and the race to uncover the individual beneath the wreckage was on. Ephraim and I stood up straighter, watching with bated breath, both of us wondering if the trapped individual could be Nikolai. It took them almost 10 minutes to clear away the rubble. When they pulled the body free, I caught sight of a flash of blonde hair and knew whoever it wasn't our missing friend. We watched as the rescuers carried the individual off to one side and laid her, we could see that it was a woman now, down on a clear stretch of lawn. Two of them went to work performing CPR immediately, but it was clear even at this distance that it was already too late. It didn't take them very long to acknowledge that fact either, and when they at last sat back on their haunches, others moved in and manhandled the corpse into a body bag, zipping it shut with an air of finality. With two people on either side, they lifted it up by the straps and carried it across the lawn to where a canopy had been erected well behind the barricades. I could see another bag lying there and was suddenly consumed with the need to get a look at the faces of the dead. But first, I needed to know if Nikolai was somewhere under all that rubble. Run interference for me, big fella?
Fine.
I knew he'd keep the riffraff away from me while I did what needed to be done and didn't hesitate to close my eyes and let my hands fall to either side. I waggled my fingers momentarily, as though loosening them up before a piano concert, and then sent my senses outward. Seeking, searching, hunting for our missing comrade. Had any of the bystanders been able to see into the ethereal realm, they would have glimpsed long, mist-like tendrils of silver-blue power wafting across the ground before me. When those tendrils reached the edge of the debris field, they hesitated for a moment, as if considering the mission before them, then dove into the wreckage like striking serpents, twisting under and over and through the debris, seeking out pockets of space between the material where a body might be hiding. I covered the area backwards and forwards twice over, finding one more body, also dead. The rescuers hadn't located yet, but the individual was too small to be Nikolai. I released my spell, letting the power dissipate, and opened my eyes. A wave of dizziness swarmed over me, and I would have fallen if Ephraim hadn't reached out and caught my elbow.
Hey, you all right?
Mm-hmm. Maybe it was the sudden change in perspective, or just simple exhaustion after using too much energy the night before. I didn't know. But it took me a minute to get myself together. I was going to have to be careful about doing anything of an arcane nature until I could get more rest. Nikolai isn't in the church.
Well, that's a relief. I think.
I knew exactly how he felt. It was a good thing that our shape-shifting friend wasn't lying beneath all that crushed rock and rubble, But that raised the question of just where he'd gotten off to, and if he'd done so under his own power. The next step is checking those body bags under that tent. Come on. I glanced about a couple of times along the way, but thankfully no one was paying us any attention. That changed as we approached the canopied area, however. A weary firefighter got up from where he'd been sitting on a folding chair and barred our way.
I'm sorry, but this is a restricted area.
He was young, maybe 25 or so, and had his fireproof jumpsuit pulled down to the waist, showing off a muscular frame that spoke to the physical nature of his job and the hard work he put in to be ready for it. Unfortunately for him, the perfection of that frame was spoiled by a narrow face and a short mustache that made him look like he belonged in a 70s porn flick instead of the annual firefighter's calendar. I pulled out the cardboard billfold I'd prepared back at the safe house and flashed it at him, holding it open along one side so he could see both interior panels and the markings I'd scribbled on them.
What can I help you with, Detective?
Scully. Detective Scully. I hadn't been going for humor, honestly. It was just the first name I could think of. I really hoped the nice young firefighter wasn't a fan of old American television shows. Thankfully, he didn't even bat an eye at the name, just glanced over my shoulder at Ephraim and raised an eyebrow. My partner, Detective Novak.
Good to meet you both. I'm Lieutenant Konechny.
Lieutenant, we need to take a look at the bodies.
This way.
He led us over to where the two body bags were laid out next to each other on the lawn and stood watching as I squatted down next to the one on the left. I unzipped the bag about a foot and a half, then pulled the right portion of the heavy plastic to one side, exposing the face of the corpse lying inside. The corpse was that of a woman, and for a split second it was Assistant Director Black lying there, her long hair partially obscuring one side of her sharply featured face. But then I blinked and realized I was wrong. This woman was about the same age, early 40s, but she was blonde, where Black was brunette, and her features were much softer than those of the assistant director. Wide blue eyes were paired with thick, full lips, which would have been a pleasing combination if it weren't for the entry wound around her left temple. I reached into the bag and turned her head. The bullet's exit had left a gaping hole in the back of her skull. I didn't recognize her, but suspected she was one of the Angel's people, as Black and her colleagues had been the ones with the firearms, and it was unlikely that she'd been taken out by friendly fire. I held the plastic to one side so Ephraim could get a good look. He shook his head. He didn't recognize her either.
Looking for someone in particular?
I didn't answer, turning around instead and giving the other bag my attention. This one contained a dark-haired male dressed in black fatigues. Him, I recognized. He was one of the men from Marcus's squad. Unlike the woman, this corpse hadn't fallen victim to gunfire. His throat had been torn open from ear to ear. That was going to be hard to explain as the result of gang warfare. But hey, not my problem.
Emergency services took two other corpses to the morgue earlier this morning.
The morgue?
Yeah, a man and a woman. They were close to the entrance of the ossuary, so the team was able to get them pretty quickly after we arrived on site.
The fact that they were headed to the morgue instead of the hospital said all there was to say about just how quickly they'd been pulled free of the rubble. But I didn't see the point of harping on the issue. Can you describe them?
Sorry. I was still working to put out the fire at that point, so I never got a look at them.
Perhaps you can tell us how to get to the morgue then.
Now that I can do.
The morgue, we soon discovered, was in the basement of the Kutnahora Hospital on the other side of the city, some 7 miles to the southeast. I was all for regular exercise, but that seemed just a bit too far to walk after the previous night's shenanigans. Both taxis and Uber were available, but we thought it might look a little strange for two supposed BSI agents to be taking a car service everywhere we went. So in the end, there was only one option that made sense: stealing a car. There were plenty of options on the street near the Bone Church, but there were far too many people out and about for my comfort. We needed to get away clean, and it was unlikely that we were going to be able to do so with that many potential witnesses. Instead, we walked a couple of blocks over to a quiet residential area where a good selection of Skodas, Dachas, and Hyundais lined either side of the street. I brought my hands up, intending to use my magic to seek out a vehicle that had been left unlocked, but Ephraim put his hand on my arm.
Save it. We don't have any idea what's ahead of us, so it's probably better if you didn't wear yourself out on the little things, in case we need you for the big stuff later. Trust me, I've got this one.
A former priest with a particular set of skills. Who knew?
All those hours of playing Grand Theft Auto should be good for something.
He marched straight over to a bright red Skoda Scala, packed a few vehicles away from us. The four-door sedan looked like a cheap BMW, with its sporty look and rounded curves. He reached out, grabbed the handle, and pulled sharply. A tug, and he tore apart the lock holding the door shut by dint of sheer force, and then he was sliding into the driver's seat with barely a moment of hesitation. I hurried to catch up. By the time I slid into the passenger seat, he had torn the ignition cover off and was getting ready to jam a screwdriver into the slot. Where'd you get that?
Get what?
The screwdriver.
A drawer in the kitchen.
Just in case you needed to unscrew something?
Something like that.
Ephraim grinned in my direction and then popped the clutch, pulling away from the curb without even a backward glance, leaving me doubting the wisdom in letting him drive, but stuck with doing so for the simple reason that I'd never learned to drive a stick. Fifteen minutes later, we were pulling into the hospital parking lot. Kutnahora Hospital was a three-story concrete building shaped like an L, with a tile roof the color of sandstone. The presence of rectangular windows, just a few inches off the ground, told us there was at least one additional level below ground. The building sat back from the road on a landscaped lot of brilliant green. It was a pleasant-looking place, which somehow made it totally apropos that it also housed the local morgue. Even the dead like to rest amidst nice scenery. Ephraim was about to remove the screwdriver when I put out a hand to stop him. Better not. We might need to make a quick getaway. I wasn't worried about anyone seeing it. If someone was paying enough attention to the car to spot it, we were probably already in trouble anyway. I still had my fake cardboard ID as we walked inside. I headed straight for the elevator bank.
Where to?
Down.
You sure?
Have you ever been to a morgue that was on an upper floor?
Huh. You've got a point.
Yeah, because the living don't like sharing space with the dead, I thought, with an unexpected bitterness that surprised me. Where the hell had that come from, I wondered, but didn't have time to give it any more thought as the elevator came to a stop and the door dinged open. We stepped out and headed down the hall as if we knew where we were going. I'd learned long ago that the saying about carrying a clipboard and acting like you belong was true. You didn't, in fact, even need the clipboard. People tend to not get involved with things that aren't their business, and if you look like you know where you're going, they will generally leave you to it. The signs on the walls were all in Czech, which I didn't speak a lick of, but I had a hunch that the ones marked Marnice might be leading us in the right direction, and I followed them like a heat-seeking missile. A few lengthy corridors and a turn or two brought us to a dead-end stretch of hallway. At the end was a set of double doors, with the word Marnice over them in big black letters. We'd found the morgue. Inside, we found a row of sinks, a pair of autopsy tables, and a rear wall of refrigerated drawers in two rows of five each. A sheet-covered body rested on each table, so that seemed the logical place to start.
Watch the door. Give me a signal if anyone's coming.
Ephraim nodded and took up position with the door cracked open slightly so he could see down the hallway in the direction we'd just come from. I stepped over to the first of the autopsy tables and, taking a deep breath, drew the sheet down to just above the waist. The body beneath was that of an elderly man in his late 60s. A Y-shaped incision ran across the center of his chest, mute testimony to the fact that he'd already been autopsied. That meant he couldn't have been brought over from the church that morning. There was no way they'd have organized the procedure that quickly. I pulled the sheet back up and moved over to the next table. I repeated the process, pulling the sheet down to allow me a look at the corpse lying beneath. This one was of a woman, roughly the same age as the man beside her. Her eyes were closed, her long silver hair combed and carefully laid out around her shoulders. She, too, had already been autopsied. Something told me the pair were a couple, and I wondered what had happened to them to have had them end up here instead of the local funeral home. I didn't see any evidence of violence, and autopsies usually weren't ordered for those who died of natural causes. At least, not back in the States, they weren't. Maybe things were different here. Either way, the answer wasn't going to help me find Nikolai. I pulled the sheet back up and started to turn away, intending to start checking the bodies in their cold storage drawers behind me. I must have jostled the table as I did so, for the woman's arm slipped off the edge and hung down toward the floor, swaying slightly. The sight of it stopped me in my tracks. I couldn't just leave it hanging there. I didn't know the woman, but it seemed disrespectful somehow. I reached over, gently lifting her arm, intending to slip it back underneath the sheet where it belonged. No sooner had I touched her than her wrist twisted in my grasp like a striking snake, and her cold, dead fingers wrapped themselves around my arm in a grip as strong as steel. I tried to make sense of what was happening, even as the woman used her hold on me as a lever, pulling herself upright so she was now sitting on the table instead of lying on it. The sheet fell to her waist in the process, and her head turned in a slow, grinding motion to face me. Her eyes popped open, their surface coated with the milky white cloudiness of death, but somehow I knew, just knew, that she could see me. That, more than anything else, freaked me out. I've seen a lot of strange shit since being snatched off the street by the project. Stuff that would send the average Joe running away screaming in fear. Vampires, shapeshifters, sorcerers with more power than you could possibly imagine. But I'd never had a corpse sit up on me, never mind turn its head to stare, and something about it kicked my brain off track. I stood there, my thoughts stuttering like an old piece of film stuck in a projector, unable to think clearly enough to call for help from Ephraim, never mind focus my power and free myself. A loud buzzing filled my ears, drowning out everything except the sound of my own breathing, which was becoming more erratic with every passing second. That's when the corpse began pulling on my arm, dragging me closer. I'll admit it, I panicked at that point. With my free hand, I began frantically yanking on the fingers wrapped around my wrist, while at the same time pressing my feet into the floor, trying to keep me from getting any closer, to no avail. Her fingers were like bands of steel cable, unyielding, and my shoes slid slowly across the tiles beneath them, inexorably drawing closer as the corpse pulled me toward her. The antiseptic scent of the soap they'd used to wash the body filled my nostrils and settled at the back of my throat like a half-chewed piece of food that had gotten stuck. I'd given up on trying to pry her fingers free and had resorted to pounding at her hand with my own, the meaty slap of flesh hitting flesh sure to bring Ephraim to my side. Except it didn't, and I was now pulled up against the side of the autopsy table, my face just inches from her own. I looked down in horror as her lips parted. God, she spoke to me in a dry, raspy voice that stank of death and corruption.
I see you, little bird. I see you.
The white noise in my head grew until it drowned everything else out, my vision tunneling as darkness swept in from all sides.
Jessica?
Ephraim's voice brought me back to myself with a start. I turned my head to find him staring at me from his position by the entrance door. What?
Stop messing around with that corpse and check the drawers.
Corpse? I thought. I turned to find myself standing next to the sheet-covered body of the dead woman on the autopsy table, her arm held gently in my hand. Memory surged. I practically flung her arm away from me as I instinctively recoiled.
Jessica, what's wrong?
He took a few steps toward me and then glanced back at the entryway, torn between his concern for me and the task that I'd given him to keep anyone from sneaking up on us. You didn't see that?
You mean you standing there holding her hand? Of course I saw that. Why do you think I told you to stop screwing around? Wait, did you know her or something?
Just seconds earlier, I had been fighting for my life against a reanimated corpse, and he hadn't seen a thing from just a few feet away? That's all you saw?
What else was there to see?
I looked back at the corpse lying beneath the sheet. Had it all been in my head? Nothing. Never mind.
You sure?
Yeah, I'm good. Sorry. Keep your eye on the door. He went back to watching the door as I took a deep breath to steady myself. I noticed with a shiver that the woman's hand was still hanging down beside the autopsy table, swinging back and forth in little arcs thanks to the momentum I'd given it. It could hang there until the end of time for all I cared. No way in hell was I touching that corpse again. Skirting the table, I made my way to the bank of cold storage drawers at the rear of the room. Grabbing the nearest handle, I opened the bay door and peered inside. Empty. I repeated the process twice before finding one with a body inside. When I did, I pulled the drawer all the way out and pulled the sheet down to the corpse's shoulders, being careful not to touch the body as I did so. The drawer held a man in his mid-30s, with a thick beard and shaved head. He was wearing street clothes and was covered head to toe in ash and dust. Two bullet wounds were clearly visible on his upper chest. I grabbed the chart hanging off the end of the drawer by the man's feet. He'd been brought in less than 2 hours earlier after being pulled from the rubble of the bone church. Bingo. One down, one to go. Given the lack of uniform, I assumed he was part of the Angels' entourage. I studied his face for a moment, trying to see if I remembered him from the night before, but I'd only seen the Angels' companions briefly before everything had gone straight to hell, and I couldn't place him. No matter. He wasn't Nikolai, and that's what mattered. I moved on to the next drawer, which held the other corpse transported from the church earlier. When I pulled the sheet down, I discovered that the woman's face had been literally torn away, the wet gleam of bone poking through the place where her flesh would have been, making it impossible to identify her with just a glance. I pulled the sheet down farther, taking note of the black fatigue she was wearing and the wide scar that ran across her left hand. I racked my brain, trying to remember if I'd seen a scar like that before. Could it be? I wondered. Ephraim! Does she look familiar to you?
I don't know. Maybe. Should she?
She doesn't look a bit like Assistant Director Black to you?
I mean, her face is...
Yeah, I know that, but...
No, it can't be Black. She's too short.
Now that he'd said it, I realized he was right. The body on the table in front of us couldn't have been more than 5'6", 5'7" at the most. Black was almost 6 feet tall. Wishful thinking, I guess. So much so that it was the second time that day that I'd hoped it was Black's corpse in front of me. Apparently, I wasn't the only one wishing the same.
I hear you. Taking that bitch out of the equation would go a long way to making me feel better. Now if we could just...
What are you two doing in here?
Turning, I found a tall, gray-haired man standing in the now open doorway, staring at us. The green scrubs he was dressed in suggested he was either the coroner, or at the very least, someone on the coroner's staff. The look of irritation on his face told me he wasn't happy to see us. I took a few steps toward him and flashed my badge. We're with BSI. We'd like to ask you a few questions about the bodies that came in this morning. He looked at me like I'd suddenly sprouted another head, and his irritation visibly deepened.
Do you think I'm an idiot? That's nothing but a scribbled on piece of cardboard.
Shit! This guy was a null, apparently. One of the scattered few who, by some lucky stroke of genetics, were immune to the effects of magic. There were probably less than a few thousand of them in existence. I'd heard of them, but hadn't yet encountered one in the wild, only heard about them in training. Until now, that is. Before I could respond, however, Ephraim crossed the room with supernatural speed, and I caught the flash of violet in his eyes as he tried to use his mesmer ability to control our sudden visitor. I'd seen him use that power before. It was like a Jedi mind trick. These are not the droids you are looking for and all that shit. Usually it worked like a charm, but Ephraim hadn't realized he was facing a null, and his effort had no more effect than my homemade BSI badge.
Stay right where you are. I'm calling security.
We must not have looked all that threatening, for he turned his back on us and marched over to the phone hanging on the wall by the door, snatching up the receiver and punching the numbers on the keypad with one stiff finger. When Ephraim glanced back in my direction in disbelief, I saw his canine teeth lengthening, a sure sign he was about to rip the guy's throat out, and I frantically signaled that we didn't want to leave another body in our wake. Thankfully, he understood. As the doctor waited for someone to pick up the phone at the other end of his call, Ephraim glanced about, grabbed a metal pan holding several surgical instruments from the counter nearby, and swung it against the back of the guy's head. The pan rang like a bell, and I'm sure the guy's head did as well. He dropped like a rock.
Hello?
Quick, we need to get him out of sight and then get the hell out of here.
I think I hit him too hard.
I hurried over, and when I got to his side, I saw what he meant. His victim was lying on the floor, blood leaking out from under him. I squatted down beside him, being careful not to get any of the blood on me, and felt his neck for a pulse. It was there, strong and steady. I breathed a sigh of relief. A closer look at the back of the man's head revealed a decent slice in his scalp where the edge of the instrument pan must have struck him. He's good. Scalp wounds just bleed a lot.
What are we going to do with him?
I wasn't sure. I looked around, hoping for an office or even a closet to put him into, but there wasn't anything of the sort. Which left one obvious choice. Grab his legs. I moved over and picked him up by the arms. Ephraim did as I suggested, and together we got him over to the bank of coal drawers at the back of the room. I grabbed the handle of the first one I'd examined a few minutes earlier and pulled it open for the second time that day.
You're not seriously going to leave the guy in there, are you?
Got a better idea?
No, but still.
Okay, so it wasn't the greatest idea I'd ever had, but I didn't want to leave him just lying in the middle of the floor where someone could stumble upon him. Hopefully he didn't have a heart attack when he woke up and figured out where he was. We lifted him up and got him situated in the pull-out drawer, lying flat on his back, hands at his sides, and then pushed the drawer 90% of the way closed. That way, he'd be able to extricate himself when he awoke, if no one found him before then. Ephraim pointed to the small puddle of blood our victim had left behind on the floor.
What are we going to do about that?
Nothing. We've got to go.
We can't just leave it there. What's the point of hiding him if you're going to leave that out on the floor for any passerby to see?
He had a point, but we simply didn't have time to deal with it properly. I cast about for a moment and then spotted the roller basket of dirty scrubs in the corner. Hustling over, I grabbed a handful and carried them back over to where Ephraim was standing, then dropped them on top of the blood, hiding it from view. Satisfied?
That wasn't so hard, was it?
Sometimes I hate when he's right. Rather than answering him directly, I turned and headed for the door. We still hadn't found Nikolai, and every minute that passed left him in possible mortal danger.